Oh, yeah.
So thank you so much. Thanks, Laura, for the introduction, and thank you for having me. I'm really delighted to be here. And as Laura mentioned, I'm sort of part-time now, but I used to give a ton of talks on legal topics and to law students and the like. But my passion now really is to speak to women and especially to moms. And the reason for that is that being a mom is hard. So super, super hard. And my own sort of transition and journey to motherhood, I think, gives a little perspective to the topic of rest. And really just the transition was one that was sort of difficult for me. And it starts way back, as all of our stories do. But I grew up as the daughter of an alcoholic. And because of that, I think my sisters and I have all long had a performance-based mentality. So throughout high school, whatever it was we were doing, we tried to succeed and do those sorts of things. And as Laura mentioned, through a sort of random, only God could do these types of things, circumstances, I ended up at one of the best law schools and clerking for one of the best judges. But the thing was, I never felt like I was quite good enough. I was always terrified that I would mess up, that I would take this new job that I'd gotten and look totally amazing, and find out that I just couldn't do it. So I worked really, really hard. And my sort of the thing I resorted to when I was afraid, which was always, was that by working harder, I would just be able to get it done. And that actually worked pretty well for me until I had children. And as you all know, children, it doesn't necessarily work when you just work harder. And so we had moved back to Missouri by this point, and I was teaching at the law school, and we had our first child, and I was able to stay home that semester. And it was in the middle of winter and super cold, and there were germs everywhere, so I didn't even really go outside. And I was working on a paper, so I didn't have tenure yet. I was trying to host Bible studies when Josh was out of town, and it was just this madhouse. And I remember walking one evening when Josh was home, and it sounds overly dramatic, but there's the Psalm 79, verse 3, and it says, "They poured out my blood like water all around Jerusalem." And that's just how I felt. Like, I was trying to do all of this, and I was failing on every level, and there just wasn't enough of me. I wasn't enough. And later that evening, as I was nursing, and I should mention, our oldest son, Elijah, is wonderful now, but he was a horrible baby. So he had acid reflux, like serious acid reflux, and so he would overeat to soothe his stomach, and then he would just have worse acid reflux. So I spent miles walking up and down the stairs in our house, because for some reason that little jostling motion seemed to help. We had one of those this like swing bassinet things that are now illegal, and it was a lifesaver, but don't use them. So, because the only way he could sleep is if he was upright a little bit. And I remember trying to place him in this swing. Like, I would nurse him to sleep. Again, I know you're not supposed to do that. It's the only way he'd go to sleep. So I would nurse him to sleep, and then the swing would be moving, and I would like try to put him in the swing as it was moving, because otherwise he would wake up. So just not a great sleeper. We had just time with his acid reflux, tried different diets, all those sorts of stuff, and nothing helped. So I was really at my wit's end, and so I was holding him one evening, I think it's about 3 in the morning, and it just hit me, like, God could have made this easy. Like, he's all-powerful, he's all-sovereign, he could have made babies that sleep through the night from the get-go. He could have, and he could have made me a mom who knew what I was doing, and he could have changed all of this. And having grown up on a ranch, it's really true that so many animals in the natural kingdom do come out much less dependent. So baby calves are up jumping around in the first couple of days, they nurse, they actually have babysitters. So cows will have this group of calves that they watch, and the moms go off and socialize and eat and that sort of thing. At a very, very young age. And so just thinking about this, like, you know, why are humans so different? Why are they so very, very dependent? And we all have our own story, as C.S. Lewis says. But I think for me, one of the reasons that I've understood is why my kiddos were so dependent is because it really showed me the type of relationship that God wanted from me. So Jesus, it's fascinating. He talks a lot about children. And this is so unusual for the time period. There's a great book by historian Owen Bakke, and the title of the book is How Christianity Invented Children. And the reason, yeah, which sounds so strange, but the reason that the book is titled this is because at that time period, children really were considered non-persons. The Roman culture was very, very harsh with children. Even the Jewish culture didn't see them in the same light that we might today after Jesus. So in this time period, Jesus talks a lot about children. And some of my favorite verses are when the disciples are arguing, as they sometimes did, gotta love them, about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So you got, you know, I'm going to be the greatest. No, I'm going to be the greatest. I'm going to be the greatest. And what Jesus does here is so revolutionary. He grabs a small child and brings that child to him and sets him on his lap. And he says, guys, this is what the kingdom of heaven looks like. This is what the greatest in the kingdom of heaven looks like. And later on in another gospel, he even puts a finer point on it. And he says, if you even want to enter into the kingdom of heaven, you must become like a small child. I just love that thought. As revolutionary as it was in that time period, I think it's also revolutionary in our time period. Susan Yates, who I think you had as a guest not long ago, and she talks about the difference between growing up spiritually and growing up just physically and in the normal course of life. And she talks about growing up in the normal course of life. We teach our children to be responsible. We teach them to be independent. We teach them to be self-sufficient. But growing up spiritually is the opposite of that. We need to become more dependent on Jesus. We need to become more attuned to him. And I think that point is so true. And that's what we see in our children. And through this lens, God really opened my eyes just to see my kids as he did. You know, their joy. I've got the two boys, as she mentioned, and as Tiffany knows, my boys are crazy. But they find joy in everything. From the rain this morning, they were jumping in puddles. Isn't this the best morning ever, Mom? Like, no, it's awful. But they love it. We found a dead mole back in Missouri. And it's like, no, this is not joyful. And they love those sorts of things. And they risk and they trust and they're transparent. They make these outrageous requests that we're scared to make in our own prayers. And they sort of show us what it looks like to have this sort of intimate relationship with God. And one of my favorite sort of memories is when Blaze, our youngest, was probably 2.5. He was pretty little. And he had the norovirus. And some of you guys have probably experienced this. Its other name is the winter vomiting bug, because it happens in winter and because your children vomit and vomit and vomit some more. And it was so awful. He had 103-degree temperature, and it wouldn't break. And I seriously called a pediatrician had a nurse hotline, and I seriously called the nurse hotline twice that night. Like, are you serious? The 103 temperature is okay. It's fine. Just make sure it's not dehydrated. But he finally went to sleep, and his arms are wrapped around my neck. We're kind of cuddled up in bed, and he is just, like, pressed as tight as he can against my chest and against my neck. And he's finally asleep, so I'm trying to untangle him so that he can get some sleep and so he can be a little cooler without me holding him. And let me tell you, Blaze was having none of it. I mean, he just shrieked and grabbed me as tight as he could, even when he was so hot. And I think for me, that's a picture of the desire that we should want to have to be with Jesus, especially when we're burning up. This past year has been difficult for a number of reasons, and I think it's in those seasons when jobs are tough, or kids are tough, or marriages are tough, when you move, or you have transitions, that it really is in those instances that Jesus is waiting there, and all we have to do is hang on, and he is all-sufficient. So those are some of the reasons that I just love seeing in our kiddos the things that Jesus desires to see in us. And I wanted to talk to you today, because it's Northern Virginia, and because we are all moms, about rest. And I think this is something else that we can see in our children, just the beauty and the theological nature even of rest. And I don't know about you, but I love to sneak into my boys' rooms at night. I just love that. And they sleep in dramatically different postures. The older one has always been hot-blooded, so like sleeps just in his underwear. And his covers are kicked off, and he's strewn out like this and snoring. And my little one, he still wears the cute little footy pajamas, even though he's 5. And he's got like 5 blankets tiled on top of him, and his bottom's up in the air, and his head scrunched down on the pillow. And it's just hysterical. But the commonality between the two of them is just their absolute peace. Like, their face are just slack with peace, and they really encapsulate that Old Testament word of shalom, just complete and perfect peace and well-being. And I just love seeing that in them. And I think that I am fascinated by rest and sleep, and that it's not unusual in America, even putting aside the category of moms, which we know is much more intense. There was a study that came out by the CDC in 2013 and sort of identified our lack of sleep as a public health crisis. And the lack of sleep can contribute to industrial disasters. It can contribute to automobile accidents, obviously, but also to hypertension, diabetes, high blood pressure, even cancer and depression can be linked to this lack of sleep. And I was just thinking, like, if this was a new disease or something, you know, the coronavirus or something new, we'd be having congressional hearings, we'd be having all these studies done. But in America, we know we don't have enough sleep, so we're sort of immune to these statistics. And it hit me watching our kiddos that we're not only immune or used to our lack of sleep, but we've really forgotten, or at least I've really forgotten, how to rest. Because biblical rest is much more than even sleep. And Elijah, a year or so ago, came to wake me up in the morning. It's about 5 in the morning. He just looks at me and says, "Mama, I can't sleep. Can you help me?" And so I carried him back up to his room. So it was upstairs at that time. And he was asleep before we even got to his room. But I think in that question, and that statement in that question, "Mama, I can't sleep. Can you help me?" that we can learn really three theological truths about rest. And the first one is simply that we're finite. We're not God. We are created, and he is the creator. So our bodies have limits. Second is that our ability to rest, to truly rest, is really contingent on our trusting in me. Elijah could rest because I was carrying him. So we need to have that abiding, that dwelling in our Creator God in order to really rest. And third, and maybe my favorite today, is that rest is a gift. God didn't institute the day of Sabbath. He didn't institute that to give us another command, something else to do, but in order to give us a gift that we need, but also one for our own enjoyment. So I wanted to unpack each of those a little bit this morning and to think first about rest as limit. So I really love this fact, but in researching for my book, I discovered that in the Jewish tradition, does anybody know what the start of the day is for the Jewish culture? Yeah, it's sundown. I just love this. So in the Jewish tradition, the day did not start with the morning break new, but rather it begins with the setting sun. And I think this day-night inversion really says something deeply theological, because for the ancients, the day began by closing their eyes and resting. And it was only once they had rested and depended on God that they were able to join him, wake up and join him in what he was already doing. So I love this idea that our day can begin with rest. And Eugene Peterson says, "The Hebrew evening-morning sequence conditions us to the rhythms of grace. We go to sleep, and God begins his work." Just love this idea that God is at work so that we can go to sleep. And Psalm 127:2 really says as much. It says, "It is in vain for you to rise up early and to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved even in his sleep." I love this idea. Like, even when we're asleep, God is not. He is constantly working. And maybe there's that problem that I just can't solve. It keeps going on and on my head. Maybe the best thing I can do actually is sleep and allow God to do his work. In fact, none other than D.A. Carson suggests that sleep might itself be a spiritual discipline. So if we were to talk about today, what do you think might be the godliest thing that you could do today? Also, there are all sorts of examples, but what might you say would be the godliest thing you could do? Yeah, praying. That's a great one.
Serving others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, serving others, taking a meal to a mom, helping someone out, for sure.
Read the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Reading the Bible. Absolutely.
So,
yeah, absolutely. So yeah, those are all really good examples of things we're called to do as Christians. But what T.A. Carson says here is so interesting to me. He says, sometimes the godliest thing you can do in the universe, not even in a day, in the universe, is to get a good night's sleep. not pray all night, but sleep. And I'm certainly not denying, he says, that there may be a place for praying all night. I'm merely insisting in the normal course of things that spiritual discipline obligates you to get the sleep your body needs. And I just love this, almost this permission to recognize sleep as part of the pattern that God instituted in our own lives because of our finiteness, because of our createdness. And that this is something that God made us with, and it's okay to rest, it's okay to sleep. In fact, it's necessary and good so that we can function and participate in what God has called us to do. So that's sort of rest as limit. And I think, yeah, for me, I wouldn't even list probably sleep on the top five. There's this funny statistic, and it makes sense when you calculate it by the hours, but they say that by the time we're 60, we will have slept for about 20 years. isn't that horrifying? It's like, I could get a lot done in 20 years. Like, seriously. But again, we're finite. And this sleep is the way that our bodies are made and the rest that we need in order to participate. And I love Tish Harrison Warren, and she puts it like this. She says, for Christians, the act of ceasing and relaxing into sleep is an act of reliance on God. And I really love that quote. And I think that brings us to the second thing, sort of the theological thing we can glean from watching our children sleep. And the kind of a funny story, I won't tell it as he gets older, but when my youngest was probably about 8 or 9 months, he was mostly sleeping through the night, but still up at his 5 o'clock feeding. And he was a super good sleeper, unlike his brother. So it's a really easy baby. But he would wake up for 5 o'clock, and for whatever reason, by the time, you know, 5:15 rolled around, he would just be grimacing and groaning after I'd put him back down. He had lots of gas, and more gas. But the funniest thing happened. Like, as soon as I picked him up, he was totally fine, sleeping peacefully, which makes no sense, right? Like, there's no way my holding him possibly helped with his digestive comfort. But the fact that mom was holding him allowed him to sleep peacefully. And I think in this sort of this picture of a baby sleeping in mother's arms, we see this in air raids and just in horrific situations of human hardship where babies are just peacefully sleeping in mom's arms. And I think this sort of encapsulates that biblical rest is more than sleep. It's actually, I think we could use the word that you were using to focus on, of dwelling or abiding. And the Old Testament phrase abiding has a really wonderful meaning. It means to dwell in, for one thing, to remain, to stay, or to wait. And all of these sorts of words have at their center just like an intimate connectedness. And as moms, we know this so well. Social psychologists tell us that for abiding is actually something super critical to newborns because they don't realize they're separate from their mom yet, that they're an extension of their mom. So they're a complete horror when mom's not there. Like, what? A part of me is gone. I don't exist. And I think that this is, even again, the sort of intimate relationship that God calls us to abide in him. And I love, I think it's so humbling to me when we read about in John, about Jesus at the well. And that chapter tells us that Jesus was weary, so he sat down. So Jesus took human form, and even Jesus, the Son of God, was weary. So it's okay to be weary. But the thing Jesus was he was never out of communion with his Father. So it's okay to be flat out exhausted. It's okay to be bone weary. I've been there and sometimes still am. But the thing that Jesus teaches us is even in that state of complete physical and mental exhaustion, we can be connected to our Father God, and we can be in communion with him. We can be abiding in Jesus and resting in him, even as we work in the middle of the night with our newborns. And one of my favorite really invitations in the Bible is in John 15. And Jesus says, remain in me, wait in me, stay in me, dwell in me, be connected to me. He says, abide in me. And even as the Message translation puts it, he says, live in me, make your home in me, just as I do in you. And again, I think we can see from Jesus' life, that doesn't necessarily mean we have to get 8 hours of sleep, as glorious as that would be, but rather just to remain connected to our Father God. So I'm getting short on time here. So I also wanted, I think when we think about our children and this idea of abiding, it's also helpful just to think of the way they trust our parents. Again, one evening, I was getting Blaze out of the car seat, and he usually didn't transfer well from car seat to bed, but this time he was just totally out cold. And his entire weight just pressed against my chest as I took him upstairs to put him to bed, just a complete leaning weight. And it reminded me of the story I'd heard told by Nicky Gumbel from HTB Church in London. And he tells the story of John Patton, who was a missionary to the New Hebrides Island. Pretty staunch missionary, pretty amazing wife. Just about 10 years before John and his wife, who was soon to be pregnant, arrived at the island of New Hebrides, another missionary couple had gone and been eaten by the local people. So a dangerous place to be, but John Patton wanted to serve, and he wanted to translate John into this native language. But what he discovered was that there was no, in this cannibalistic culture, it's a very, very fraught culture, very dangerous culture, very brutal culture, And there was no word for trust or faith. So how do you translate John without using words like trust or faith? And one day he had an idea. He talked to his housekeeper, and he said, "What am I doing now?" And he leaned back in a chair with 2 feet off the ground, just sort of leaned there balancing. And the gentleman responded with a word that meant to lean your whole weight upon. And I love that idea, that trust or faith means that we lean our whole weight upon Jesus. So we don't hang on to our self-sufficiency like I'm likely to do, or to our reliance or what we can get done, but we lean our entire weight on Jesus. And I think, again, that's something that we see in our kids, is they just trust us to provide. And then the last thing I wanted to talk to you about today is just the fact that rest is a gift, that we have this invitation from Jesus. And as he sends the disciples out, I think it's in Mark 6, he just sends the disciples out in two by two, and he commands them to heal the sick. He commands them to cast out demons. He commands them to preach the gospel. And they do all of these things, and they come back flat exhausted. The Bible tells us that they didn't have time even to eat. So they come back to Jesus, and they're like, "Jesus, we did it, but we're bone weary." They needed, you know, hot meal and a good nap. But what Jesus does here is so interesting. What he does is he doesn't say, "Go away and get some sleep. I'll see you in the morning." What he says is, "Come away with me." And I love that. Not go away and get sleep, but come away with me. And I think that's the invitation that we have every day as we're poured out as moms and wives and in our busy lives. So even when things are crazy, we don't need to go away, but we can come away with Jesus and rest in him. And the thing is, as all of you know, the place doesn't have to be fancy. One of my favorite things that I once heard was about someone talking about his quiet time, his Bible reading time, as coffee with Jesus. And you sit on his porch and watch the sunrise come and have coffee and just pray and enjoy Jesus. But it was this time of sweet communion. It wasn't, you know, "I have to do this for 30 minutes, which is, you know, somewhat impossible when you've got 3 kids and they're up early and often, but just having some time, just some coffee with Jesus. I love that idea. So go by Starbucks and have coffee with Jesus. And also this sort of ties into just this idea that rest was meant for our freedom, not to impose an additional requirement. And I think in a good example of this from a child's perspective is my oldest, you know, when he was supposed to go to bed, and he would play possum instead, and his face, like, scrunched up so tight. And I mean, he looked like he was in excruciating pain. It didn't look restful at all. But finally, peace would steal over him, sleep would steal over him, and his face would just relax. I think so often, even my desire or my striving to rest can look like me playing possum, like just holding on and trying to get the rest I need, or trying to do the things I can without relinquishing them to God. But that's not at all what God or what Jesus was referring to when they were talking about these sorts of rest. In fact, if you look at Isaiah 58, and I just love this verse, this is the Message paraphrase, but it says, "If you watch your step on the Sabbath, and don't use my holy day for your personal advantage, if you treat the Sabbath as a day of joy, God's holy day as a celebration, if you honor it by refusing business as usual, don't make money, run here and there, then you'll be free to enjoy God." Again, he's talking about the Sabbath here. You'll be free to enjoy God. It says, "Oh, I'll make you ride high and soar above it all. I'll make you feast on the inheritance of your ancestor Jacob. Yes, God says so." So I love this description of Sabbath and of rest as part of the created order that God made for us. It was meant to be a day of joy, meant to be a day of celebration in which we honor God by stopping sort of our daily routine, our scurrying here and there. And so to observe the Sabbath, author and pastor Brady Boyd writes, "You've got to know what makes you come alive." And I don't know about you, but sometimes as moms, this is kind of hard. Like you're just worrying about the day-to-day, you're pouring yourself out and caring for your children, and sometimes like, what does make me come alive? What is the something that I enjoy? And that's okay. This is a tough season. So if that's where you're at, I've been there, and I would just encourage you to start slow. Take a walk. Enjoy some flowers. Get some flowers at Trader Joe's. Find those things that your heart delights in. And again, it doesn't have to be long or fancy. But remember what it is that reminds you of God and helps you to celebrate this gift of the Sabbath that he's given you. I remember reading the same book by Brady Boyd. Actually, my husband read it first. It's kind of a funny story. But Brady Boyd, super busy pastor. He'd been the pastor of a megachurch and very successful as a pastor, but then kind of realized that life was just out of control. So he wrote this book on rest, and in it he talks about these, quote, bedhead days. And bedhead days are just when he and his kids were older, but he and his family just kind of slept in, and I don't know if it was a Saturday or what day of the week it was, but they just really lounged and took it easy. And so my husband, we had kids that were like 1 and 3 at the time. My husband's like, this is fabulous. I am going to do bedhead days. Like, So that means I'll be up with the kids again by myself. So bedhead days were not that popular in our house. But I do love the concept that even as a family, because Brady Boyd was talking about his whole family doing the sort of bedhead days and resting together. So it's a good idea. I just wouldn't recommend that husbands do it when you have a newborn. But and what's really kind of fun to me is Mark Buchanan, a pastor here in D.C., has also written extensively about rest. And there's something that he and Brady Boyd both have in common. And guess what you guys have any idea what they do on Sundays to rest? Yeah, they're pastors, big churches, so lots of responsibilities on Sundays. Nap sounds great, yes. Fish would be good. They mow their lawns. Seriously, both of them write about mowing their lawns because it's something they enjoy. And I can kind of get that. You've got the nice lines and it's something productive. But again, the point is that it's something they enjoy that they wouldn't do regularly. So even the sort of work-oriented task that we sometimes think of work, these pastors are saying it gives them life. And again, the Sabbath wasn't meant to take something away, but to give us joy. And D.A. Carson again explains how the religious leaders of the day in Jesus' time had turned God's gift of rest into a burden. And he says, instead of understanding it to be their privilege to rest on Sabbath, they viewed it as a deprivation. I know I can do that. They said instead of recognizing their opportunity to commune with God, they saw only inconvenience or hardship. Rather than discovering freedom to worship, they felt in bondage to the law, and instead of grasping the idea of renewal of their covenantal relationship with God, they experienced the tragedy of legalism. So really, in commanding the Israelites to observe Sabbath, I would submit that God meant to grant them freedom. And even again in Deuteronomy, God relates Sabbath to the rescue from Egypt. So that God brought them out of Egypt from the bondage of sin and slavery, and that Sabbath is an example of this. Even Mark Buchanan writes, Sabbath is a condition of liberty and a refusal to go back to slavery. So it's this idea that we're given this gift of Sabbath rest. So I have to tell you, I guess, two confessions. The first one is that I'm not very good at Sabbath rest, but one place that I've actually found myself being able to rest quite a lot, I don't recommend it, but it's at church on Sundays. And my husband, will elbow me. But there's just something, especially when my children were younger and not sleeping, but just kids were in Kids Wonderland. They were learning about Jesus. They were completely well cared for, just encapsulated and loved on. And I was just sitting in God's house listening to his word preached. And I would find my eyes closed. and at first I was embarrassed. I still try not to sleep on Sundays. But I got to thinking about why this was the case. Why did I fall asleep during sermons when it was so hard for me to fall asleep during other times? And I know we've all had our sleep issues. I have a thyroid issue, and it just sometimes is hard to sleep. So why could I sleep during some Sunday sermons? And I think I sort of figured a little bit of it out in that my kids were well cared for. I didn't have to worry about doing anything. I didn't have to check my phone to see if there was a work email. I wasn't supposed to check my phone. I didn't have to worry about my kids. I didn't have to worry about dishes or dinner. All I was supposed to do there was sit and learn and listen and be in God's presence. And it was just this permission to sort of abide in Jesus. So I love that idea of finding a place where you have permission, a place of Sabbath, where you can just sit and enjoy God. And to me, this is hard. Rest is elusive, and I think it's because it feels like a relinquishment. It feels like you're letting go of control and recognizing my limits and that I simply can't do it all. And I think, actually, that's kind of the point. as hard as that is to acknowledge, is I am finite. And when I am able to leave all of my work and worries to the God whose day begins in the evening as we go to sleep and continues, then I'm better able to join him in the work that he is doing. And in conclusion here, I just wanted to read one of my favorite verses. I have lots of them. But this is from the Message version, Matthew 11, 28 through 30. And Jesus says, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me. Get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly." I just love this invitation from Jesus. And so I would just encourage you, as you go about your days and your weekends, which for some reason can be more hectic with children than the weekdays, that you would just accept Jesus' invitation, that you would hear him say to you, "Dear one, come away with me. I'll show you how to live freely and lightly." So, thank you.
Thank you, Erin. So her book, I hear from a little birdie that